Hi, Patrick Cox here in the World Newsroom in Boston, and it's high time for another language news pod, where the Big Show's cartoon curator, Carol Hales, and I talk about a few language stories that have made the news, but barely. Chances you've missed most of them, or maybe even all of them. We have some nice ones this week, culled from the last 2 months, stories out of India, Sweden, Germany, South Korea, and the United Nations. So, coming up, story number 5. So, Carol, number 5 from you.
Well, as you may remember, Muammar Gaddafi spoke at the opening of the General Assembly at the UN. You know, all the leaders are there. It's a big jamboree. So he gets up. He has 15-minute allotment.
How long does he talk for?
94 minutes.
I must say, every time I looked up at the TV, whatever it was, C-SPAN or whatever, he was still going.
He's going, but, you know, the person who holds the record is an Indian guy who spoke for 8 hours in 1957 defending India's position in Kashmir. So he's nowhere near the record. But anyway.
What does that mean for the other people, you know, from so-and-so from Papua New Guinea? They just don't get to talk?
Well, I think they follow the rules and they speak for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it's the blowhards get up and go nuts. So for the first 90 minutes, Gaddafi had his own translator. He insisted on his own translator because his people said he's going to speak in a dialect. So he brought his translator with him. As it turned out, he just spoke in standard Arabic. But he goes on for 90 minutes, 94 minutes, and for 90 of those minutes, his own translator hung in there. And then he collapsed.
Poor guy. He didn't have a rest or anything?
No. And the official UN translators, they only can go 40 minutes, and then they get a rest. But he was Gaddafi's personal guy. He goes out, and he finally collapses. And one of the UN translators, Arabic translators, picks up seamlessly and continues, this woman. So she finished for him. And it's hard to tell from the reporting on it what exactly happened. I think it's pretty clear he did collapse. But one of the reports said, he said, I just can't take this anymore. And we don't know if he said that.
Right. That was the New York Post, wasn't
yes.
it? So we should treat that with it. I guess if you're Gaddafi's personal translator, you want to make sure you get it right, especially if he's going to go off on one of his theories about, you know, swine flu or JFK's assassination or something. I mean, if you get that wrong, then maybe hell to pay, you know,
exactly.
When you get back to Tripoli.
I think that's why he hung in for 90 minutes.
The most dangerous job in the world, translator for Gaddafi. Okay, well, that's number 5. Number 4 is a very, very strange story about, well, it's the little script that could. This is Hangul. We're talking about the script of the Korean language that was developed back in the 15th century.
Is it characters or ideographs?
No, it's an alphabet. It's actually a very sensible, logical script, unlike neighbors in East Asia, you know, China and Japan, that have, you know, a gazillion characters. This is just 24 letters in an alphabet. Anyway, the Koreans are extremely proud of Hangul, and for quite some time they've been trying to export it. It's only used in North and South Korea. The South Koreans, especially Christian evangelists, have been trying to export it to various places with not a huge amount of success until they got to about 3,500 miles away in a small island, which is part of Indonesia, where a language called the Chia Chia is spoken. This is an oral language only, written language. And the Koreans thought that they would bring them some script to their language. They would transliterate the language and do a script, which is something that happens an awful lot with Bible translators and evangelists, American, who will bring the Roman script. Doesn't happen very often with other scripts.
Yeah, it happened with Vietnamese and I don't know if it happened with Hmong, but there's these languages that weren't spoken until like the 1930s or something.
Right. I mean, and you know, some people consider it a kind of cultural colonization. The Indonesian government is kind of scratching its head over this, I think, more than anything else. But you may wonder, I certainly did when I saw this story, why on earth would these people who speak this small minority language in Indonesia embrace Korean of all languages? Well, it turns out that there's a bunch of money involved. It's all this brainchild of this retired real estate mogul called Lee Ki-nam, who loves Hangul. And her foundation brought a Chia Chia school teacher to Seoul and trained him up. They paid for textbooks. They're building a Korean cultural center back in the island where Chia Chia is spoken. And this is among a people who are incredibly poor. They're basically subsistence farmers. So this is all a really, really big deal. I have to say also, this is just the very beginning for this woman, Lee Ki-nam. Here is the money quote. "I am doing for the world's non-written languages what Doctors Without Borders is doing in medicine. There are thousands of such languages. I aim to bring Hangul to all of them."
That's incredible. I mean, you sort of get it intellectually what she's doing, but practically you think, wait a second. I mean, somehow it's about the preservation of language, but it's sort of throwing a curveball into it.
Absolutely.
It's odd.
Absolutely. It was pointed out in one of the news articles that I saw that, you know, Korean culture is incredibly popular right now in Asia. I thought it was only in Japan and China and Taiwan and places that things like Korean soap opera and Korean pop is popular. But it actually goes way beyond that. It is also in Indonesia. And so there's this kind of cachet about all things Korean. And that may have helped in convincing these people to adopt the Hangul script. And by the way, October 9th is Hangul Day. So, Carol, happy Hangul Day.
Wow. Thank you, Patrick.
You're very welcome.
That's very exciting.
All right. Well, what do you got for number three?
Well, number three is India, a very intensely rich linguistic and ethnic stew, as we like to say. It has a gillion languages. There's already 22 official languages.
That must be almost more than any other country, official languages.
Yeah, I think it has to be. Now there's petitions for 38 more languages to become official languages. And it has implications for the government because it means they have to present civil service exams in that language. They have to try to get it on the currency, which is tough. I don't think they have all 22 on there right now.
22 plus 30, 60 languages on a banknote.
Right. And they're saying, we just can't do that.
Couldn't they just waive that with the banknote?
But it's in the Constitution, and so they're in a bit of a bind about what to do, and that they expect many more requests for this. So it's sort of amazing. I mean, English remains the link language in India. It's the language of commerce, but there's all these, you know, hundreds of languages that still really thrive in their local area. So they're just not sure what they're going to do.
Wow. And of course, the more languages you add, potentially the less coherent the, you know, India is the great experiment in diversity, democratic diversity, is really going to be tested by this.
And they're rather successful at their democratic diversity.
Oh, I mean, no question.
Because they're not like contrived differences. I mean, they're like real groups who are have been there forever and ever and have their own cultures. And I wonder whether it's been piqued, the interest has been piqued by the gradual change of, say, place names in India and all the cities being changed. I guess they're being changed to Hindi names. I'm not sure. Or maybe they're being changed to local names. I'm not even sure whether Calcutta and Mumbai, whether they reflect
Hindi.
Listeners, let us know. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's interesting. That transitions nicely into number two, because number two is about a country that is in many ways the opposite of India, a very homogeneous country, and that's Sweden, where, you know, there's very much one language, one official language. There are also five minority languages, but, you know, the official language is basically the language that I guess 99% of people speak. The five minority languages are Finnish, Torn Valley Finnish, don't know how that's different from regular Finnish, Sami, Romani, and Yiddish. And the Swedish government has actually been under some fire for not promoting
Yiddish.
There are 3,000 Yiddish speakers in one part of Sweden.
Have they been there a long time, or is it a post-war population?
I don't know.
Wow.
Anyways, listeners, let us know. So the Swedish government has been under fire from the Council on Europe, which likes to annoy national governments about these matters, for not doing enough to promote these minority languages. And then on top of that, just recently, UNESCO has put the cat among the pigeons, or the Eurasian blackbird among the pigeons. That's the Swedish national bird. UNESCO's done this by declaring yet another tongue spoken in Sweden as, quote, a threatened language. And that tongue is Scanian, also known as Skånska. And it's a dialect spoken in southern Sweden. And it is very much a dialect as far as the Swedish linguistic authorities are concerned. This is a dialect. This is something that is essentially Swedish that has got an accent and a few weird words and expressions that are a bit different, but in no way is it a language. So they're completely up in arms at this declaration from UNESCO. I actually remember when I lived in Denmark, which is right next door to mm-hmm. that particular part of Sweden where Skånska is spoken. Skånska was laughed at by seemingly by everyone. The Swedes thought that it sounded like country bumpkin Danish, and the Danes thought it sounded like country bumpkin Swedish. It just couldn't get any respect.
It's like Canadian doubles and American doubles.
Yeah. No wonder UNESCO gave it some respect. Anyway, here is a little bit of it, as rendered by a Swede who's making fun of it. So he may not be a native Skånska speaker. And this may be a little exaggerated, but it gives you an idea.
Ja, hallå. Mitt namn är Bertil. Jag kommer från Trelleborg. Som ni hör så pratar jag skånska och kommer alltså ifrån Skåne. Men det är många i detta land som tycker att skånskan är den absolut fulaste dialekten som finns i detta land.
So that's skånska. And by way of comparison, here's a little bit of Swedish.
Frågan är hur befogad den skräcken är och om det verkligen handlar om en pandemi. När WHO kallar en smitta för pandemi så får det långtgående konsekvenser både för samhällsinstitutioner och företag.
So the Swedish authorities are going to officially completely ignore UNESCO's declaration, but unofficially they don't like it at all. And given that Skånska may not be a language at all, and given that Swedish and Danish are generally recognized as languages, even though they're very similar to one another and very similar to Skånska, may just be time to roll out that aphorism, a language is a dialect with an army and a navy.
That's a great saying. Ingers me home, diddy hoong, gada sadu. Ye bears beer, horn bears beer, bork, bork, bork.
English beer, the Swedish meatball. Yeah, it's beer, the sauce, the meatball. Okay, Carol, so what is this month's number one language story?
Well, number one concerns Germany and Nazis. It's always a provocative topic, but in this case, this is just weird. A German court has ruled that this neo-Nazi guy who used Nazi slogans on merchandise and clothing, if he used them in English, it was okay to use them. Lots of things related to the Nazi era are actually illegal in Germany. And so in Germany, you can't say this term, blood and honor, in German. And I can't remember how to say blood and honor in German.
Which is just as well, because
I might be arrested. But anyway, he made T-shirts saying blood and honor in English. And the court ruled that that's okay, that these things are okay to do them in other languages, which makes people very upset in Germany because it means that the meaning is less important than the script or letters you use, that you right. either have to kind of, you know, kind of go for it, stand up for the whole thing or not.
Well, no,
but this
yeah.
is sort of, well, if you say it in all these other languages, then it's okay.
So it must be more, if for Germans at least, it must be more potent in German.
Yes. Oh, yes. And the phrase blood and honor is associated with Hitler Youth. And so it has this very specific connotation. And many people there have a living memory of that or were part of it. And God knows how many documentaries or newsreels has one seen at this point from Germany. So this stuff is audibly available. So you can't say it in German, but you can. I don't think you can say it in. You can have it on merchandise. You can have the words. Mm. But I don't think you can. It's not clear to me in this ruling whether you can utter it. If you're a German standing in Germany and utter blood and honor.
In English.
Yeah. That's
yeah,
not clear to me.
Interesting one. Again, something that we don't really want to hear tested. But, I mean, it may be that this is one of those judicial rulings that makes sense only in its historical context after some time has passed. When we see it, you know, as part of a progression of laws that are passed where we see Germany taking a different direction as regards the language of its Nazi era. So maybe one day Mein Kampf, for example, will be allowed, permitted to be published as Germany's Jews would like, because they'd prefer to see yeah. it out in the open.
Yeah, and the other thing about this is that people are concerned that neo-Nazis will then like print lots of T-shirts and be much more public in other languages, but it's all going to be code and everybody's going to know that it's right. blood and honor. So it's very odd. I mean, yeah. I do think that the laws in Germany around the Nazi period are rather, they're sort of counterproductive or they're contradictory. It's sort of, what?
Well, on that pleasant note, Carol, thank you very much.
Anytime, Patrick.
Tell us what's going on the cartoon front.
Daryl Cagle joins me in the latest cartoon slideshow. We talk about the cartoons that I've picked for this week. And he talks a lot about stylistic differences between American and international cartoonists. You know, big themes, Afghanistan, China turning 60, global warming, usual suspects.
That's great. theworld.org/cartoons. Go check it out. That's it for this time. There's more info, links, videos, and all of that at theworld.org/language, or go to the Facebook group, The World in Words. I'll be back with a regular podcast in a few days. Thanks for listening.